I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. While the House of Representatives and the White House fight over subpoenas regarding the impeachment inquiry, which we will talk about later in the show, it looks like public opinion is slowly moving in support of the investigation into whether President Trump's conversation with the president of Ukraine about getting dirt on his political rival, Vice President Joe Biden, was an impeachable offense. Not surprisingly, Democrats largely favor the inquiry. Most Republicans oppose, and most independents are somewhere in between. And since we're in the polling season, we figure we could all use a refresher course on how to read polls and how to know which ones to trust. We asked Michael Trogott to join us. He's a political scientist at the University of Michigan who studies campaigns and elections, political communication, and how polls are used to make news. Michael Trogott, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Marty.
Is it hard to poll on impeachment because it has happened so rarely in this country?
Well, I think it is hard to poll on impeachment, but it's difficult because the information environment is changing all the time. You know, there are new disclosures virtually every day. So people's attitudes are changing as well as they learn more about the process. So it's difficult for pollsters, and it's difficult for journalists to report on the polls as well.
Well, tell me about it. I've had rewritten my intro three times this morning because the news keeps changing or the little tidbits keep getting added. But nonetheless, how do you suggest, and we have to, if we're going to understand what these polls mean and whether to trust them or not, how should a question about impeachment be posed?
Well, when we talk about polls and evaluating poll results, there are a couple of factors to keep in mind. One of them is who is asked. Another one is what were they asked? What was the question wording? And in the case of something like impeachment, it's also important to keep in mind when they were asked, especially in relation to changing events in the real world. And a further complication is journalists are very interested in reporting on changes in opinion, and that can be complicated because comparing one poll to another, a poll conducted very recently compared to one conducted 2 weeks or 2 months ago, can be complicated by any of these issues, a different sample, a different question wording, as well as the way that events can change opinions.
You mentioned who, essentially who, what, and when. In terms of the who question, it seems to me that a legitimate poll asks a broad spectrum of people for their opinion. Is there something I'm missing there?
Well, especially when we talk about political polls, there are typically three target populations that a pollster would be interested in. Most polls are conducted with samples of adults 18 years of age and over. Some polls are conducted with registered voters, and some polls are conducted with estimates of likely voters, those people who are most likely to vote in the next election. If we're talking about a national poll with a national sample, as one moves from adults to registered voters to likely voters, the sample becomes more Republican. So if you're asking about a politically charged event like impeachment of a Republican president, there should be, we would expect to see less support for impeachment among likely voters than among registered voters than among all adults.
Well, if that is true, then, and we see that what the polls seem to be indicating in the last at least couple of days is that Republicans are kind of holding firm that they oppose the impeachment inquiry. Democrats are in support, and again, independents somewhere in between. How should we interpret whether this is true or not?
Well, I think it's very important in the case of impeachment to look for data on the impeachment question, cross-tab against party ID. the Democrats are almost solidly in favor of impeachment. 9 and 10 are a little better. Republicans are pretty solidly opposed, but not as strongly. And as you said, independents are about equally divided, although across the last couple of weeks, there are more Republicans who are supporting the notion of impeachment. And also, independents are drifting towards support for impeachment. So the change is coming among independents and Republicans, not among Democrats. And so you want to look, especially within polls conducted by the same organization, mm-hmm. you know, the same methods and so on, for the movement among Republicans and independents.
So kind of orange and oranges, apples and apples comparison, that is helpful anyway?
Yes, that would be the, you know, the best thing to do. And I should point out that there are some polls that are conducted with unrepresentative samples. So you want to pay attention to who's conducting the poll. So if you see poll results, as was reported not too long ago, from the Republican National Campaign Committee, which included respondents only from Republican-leaning districts, that should be a red flag that support for impeachment is not going to be very strong in that poll.
So consider the source, whether it's Republican, Democrat, or otherwise, that if it's partisan, chances are the poll is going to be as positive as it can be even if it's not true.
On favoring that particular side, yes.
Are polls, especially with President Trump, are polls tied to approval ratings? Is that some indication of how polls play out?
Well, I don't think that they're directly linked to approval ratings in the following sense. We're living now in a period of political polarization, you know, where Democrats and Republicans have sharply divided views. That's partly what you see in the impeachment questions, and it's certainly what you see in presidential approval polls. So to the extent that you have the same phenomenon taking place, there is a kind of a linkage. But President Trump has never had very high approval ratings. He didn't really have a honeymoon period the way most prior presidents have. So I would say that the linkage is relatively weak.
Should we think of polls as a snapshot in time?
Well, most polls are conducted with a single sample at a single point in time, and they do resemble a snapshot. But with an issue like impeachment, there are so many polls, the number of polls has increased dramatically recently, that it's inevitable that people will be making these comparisons over time. And as I indicated, that can be a tricky proposition.
Are there too many polls? Are you saying that?
Well, I don't think that there are too many polls. You know, impeachment is inherently a political act.
Right.
And elected officials who will be involved in the Congress, in the House, and in the Senate in dealing with impeachment as a trial or impeachment as a kind of a jury verdict will pay a lot of attention to public opinion. So keeping them informed about how the public feels and how those feelings or attitudes are changing is very important. But there are a lot of different questions that are being asked as well. And so, again, we have an apples and oranges situation often in terms of interpreting the results.
Are there polls that you think have been better than others or more reliable than others?
Well, generally, I think the polls that are conducted by the major news organizations are pretty reliable. But some polls are asking about whether Congress should be engaged in an impeachment inquiry.
Right.
And some polls are using a question about Congress having an impeachment inquiry and removing the president from office. That obviously requires a much harsher judgment. So we would expect support for the latter question to be lower than support measured by the former question.
I'm curious if you can go back and look at polling under the impeachment of President Clinton and even going back to Nixon. He obviously resigned before he was impeached, but nonetheless, what the polling was back then at a similar time in their administration.
Well, the polling on impeachment for Trump looks a lot like the polling for impeachment for Nixon. And Nixon had relatively low approval ratings, but the impeachment of Clinton was about a lie that he told under oath,
right,
with regard to Monica Lewinsky, and his approval ratings were relatively high. The Democrats rallied behind Clinton in Congress in his defense. But the support for Nixon in the Congress dissipated rather quickly and contributed to his decision to resign. Right now, the Republicans are pretty solidly behind Donald Trump, and they are attacking in the House the Democratic inquiry. And there doesn't seem to be any indication in the Senate that there would be enough Republican defectors to convict him. But we'll have to see how, you know, additional disclosures affect that circumstance, especially in the Senate.
This is sort of a technical question, but the fact that there's so few landlines now, does that make it harder for pollsters or even harder to interpret results? Do you need a landline?
I don't think that in a well-conducted poll, it doesn't make it harder or more difficult to interpret because most polling organizations are using live interviewer polling and they have more than half of the sample coming from landlines, sometimes two-thirds or 75%. But cell phone interviews cost about twice as much as landline interviews to conduct. And so that may lengthen the field period when the interviews are conducted, and it also may affect the number of polls that a news organization can conduct. That is how frequently or how current the data would be.
Well, Michael Trogart, we have to leave it there, and I thank you for joining us on Radio Times, helping us to understand some of the nuts and bolts of polling. Thanks so much.
Good to chat, Marty.
You're very welcome. That's Michael Trogart. He's a political scientist at the University of Michigan. Again, he studies campaigns and elections, political communication, and how polls are used to make news. We've got Jacqueline Thompson waiting in the wings. She's a reporter for the National Law Journal, covering D.C. courts and the legal side of politics. We'll be talking more about the impeachment inquiry after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, there has been an onslaught of impeachment-related news ever since House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called for an inquiry several weeks ago. That was followed by the release of a whistleblower complaint that President Trump asked the president of Ukraine to dig up dirt on Vice President Joe Biden and his son and appeared to dangle nearly $400 million in aid as incentive. The White House lawyer wrote a letter to the House of Representatives saying the administration would not cooperate with the inquiry, calling it constitutionally invalid. Meanwhile, the fired ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, in defiance of the White House, testified on Friday about her removal on, quote, unfounded and false claims by people with questionable motives. Yesterday, Fiona Hill, ex-Trump Russia advisor, reportedly testified about her objection to Yovanovitch's removal and, according to the Washington Post, alleged that Rudolf Giuliani was circumventing U.S. officials and career diplomats to personally benefit Donald Trump. And just to add to the drama, there were five court rulings against President Trump on Friday, including two regarding his tax returns. We are in some uncharted waters because only two presidents in American history have been impeached, and the Trump administration is refusing to play ball. Jacqueline Thompson joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. She's a reporter for the National Law Journal covering D.C. courts and the legal side of politics. Jacqueline Thompson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times anytime to join our conversation. Jacqueline, let's go back just a couple of weeks when Nancy Pelosi, who had been reluctant to begin an impeachment inquiry, it seemed until the controversial phone call between Trump and the president of Ukraine, that seemed to be the last straw for her. How does she define this inquiry?
Definitely. You know, Nancy Pelosi had really been hesitant before to move forward on any of this. She said we need to wait for the court battles between the president and Democrats to work their way through the system and figure out what they get from there in terms of evidence. But, you know, this phone call seemed to be a really overwhelming point for her. It put her over the edge in terms of saying, yes, now we are formally in an impeachment inquiry. This differs a little bit from past impeachment inquiries in that the formalization took place in terms of the Speaker of the House making an announcement before we've seen resolutions taken to the House floor and a vote placed on them. But, you know, Democrats aren't really warming up to that idea right now, although pressure is kind of rising up for that step to be taken next.
Pressure coming from where?
A lot of Republicans are pushing for it. And frankly, a couple of Democrats are going on the record and saying, you know, the White House is saying that they aren't going to participate in this impeachment inquiry until we have a vote like this. We're seeing Republicans say there has to be a vote like this to formalize it. And we're even seeing judges in courtrooms on unrelated cases say, why don't we have a vote on this? It's interesting to kind of see all these different factors come together. And whether or not they ultimately do, I believe that, you know, that's Nancy Pelosi's call. But there's a lot of concern about whether or not it could end up adding a little bit of delegitimacy to the probe. You know, frankly, the vote would be very partisan. All Democrats would vote for it. Republicans would vote against it. And that adds another way for people to say, you know, this is a partisan impeachment inquiry.
Well, this is Pelosi not holding, at least as of yet, this full House vote on the inquiry proceedings. Does she have to do that? Are there any rules or laws or anything in the Constitution which gives us some kind of a roadmap on what to do?
She definitely does not have to do that. The Constitution really gives the House a lot of liberty and freedom in terms of how they get to carry out this probe. It basically just says the House has the sole authority to impeach the president and to bring forward articles of impeachment. It gives no guidance on how that process should be done. You know, I've been talking to a lot of lawyers who've been involved in past impeachment inquiries talking about how that process played out in the past, and they basically had to come up with it from scratch back in Watergate. You know, Andrew Johnson had been the last impeachment. That was 1868, and
yes. It
didn't offer a lot of hints on how exactly this process can play out. But, you know, past precedent does say that there should be a House full resolution on this, but, you know, she does not have to do that at all.
I'm curious about there are some Democrats that want Nancy Pelosi really wants to keep it to this whistleblower complaint largely involving Ukraine and whether the president engaged in some kind of impeachable offense by pushing pressure on the president of Ukraine. But there are some members of the Democratic Party. They want to expand it to obstruction of justice and defying subpoenas and document release. Help us understand, I guess, what's happening within the Democratic Party about the scope of this impeachment inquiry.
Sure. Yeah, the impeachment inquiry definitely is focusing on the Ukrainian allegations. But, you know, well before that, we had the findings from the Mueller report that the House Judiciary Committee was starting to hold hearings on and bringing in witnesses and hearing testimony on that front. It doesn't seem like they're willing to abandon that quite yet. Mm-hmm. The lawsuits surrounding that specific part of the inquiry are ongoing. Those involve testimony from Don McGahn, the former White House counsel, and grand jury materials that were left out of the Mueller report. So they definitely do not want to give up on those quite yet, but they are for sure more in the background than this Ukrainian investigation right now, just because it does seem to be the most compelling evidence of a potentially impeachable offense by the president. And, you know, Nancy Pelosi, she wants to get this done as fast as she can. They're eyeing a vote by the end of the year, just in time for the holidays, on potential articles of impeachment. So to move this fast and to get it done, you know, you really do have to focus on just one area.
Let me ask you about the Mueller report. Apparently not all members of Congress read it during a couple of months ago. I don't know whether they have now or not. But do you think the fact that it was complicated and long and legalistic, and the fact that we've got this this OLC memo, this Office of Legal Counsel memo, that basically says you cannot indict a sitting president, did that tie the House's hands?
I don't think it tied the House's hands. I think it tied Robert Mueller's hands in terms of what he's able to do. That OLC memo, that really just applies to the executive branch.
Right.
And the difference between what happened with Robert Mueller and, frankly, what happened with the special prosecutor in Watergate is that with the special prosecutor in Watergate, they were able to take the material to a grand jury, and the grand jury said, we believe there is enough material here and enough evidence to indict Richard Nixon. However, we are not able to do that. So they referred that matter over to Congress. That did not happen with Robert Mueller. And they did not get that directive the way that they got in Watergate. And they didn't get access to those materials that they got in Watergate, which is why we're now seeing this lawsuit for the grand jury materials, because they believe it could reveal further evidence of potentially impeachable offenses. So I think the House, frankly, could have benefited a lot if Robert Mueller said, this is not my job.
Right.
This has to be taken up by the House, because we, the only way we can hold a president accountable for any wrongdoing of this level is going to be through impeachment.
Not to get too in the weeds here, but has any court ever ruled on the Office of Legal Counsel memo that essentially says that you can't indict a sitting president? Has any court ever weighed in on that?
No, they haven't. Not explicitly on the legal merits of that opinion. And it's funny you said that, because last week we saw two federal judges and courthouses in New York and D.C. both kind of take shots at it. We had a federal judge in New York say, you know, I don't necessarily agree with this opinion because I believe it gives the president basically free rein to commit any sort of criminal offenses without facing any repercussions. And then we had a federal judge in D.C. say during oral arguments for another lawsuit involving the House and the Trump administration, she said, you know, no court has ever weighed in on this opinion. So it's very interesting to see judges start speaking up and out about this.
Is that a sign that at some point a court will rule, or at least it'll maybe make its way to the U.S. Supreme Court?
You know, it's definitely possible. I wouldn't rule it out, but I just don't see a way for it to happen right now. There's not been, say, a lawsuit directly challenging the memo or saying, you know, I have been deprived of a right because of this memo. So we'll just have to see exactly how things play out. But it raises a lot of questions, because we're seeing the White House now basically refuse to engage in this impeachment inquiry. And if they refuse to engage in the impeachment inquiry and the inquiry can't be done to its fullest way, it raises questions of how exactly a president can be held accountable in these circumstances.
I want to follow up on that, but let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Jacqueline Thompson. She's a reporter for the National Law Journal, and she covers the D.C. courts and also the legal side of politics. And we asked us to ask her to join us on Radio Times today to talk about where things stand when it comes to the impeachment inquiry, the fact that the Trump administration is not essentially abiding by any of the requirements from the House of Representatives. And you can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I was going to ask you about those two court cases, but the fact that you just talked about this letter from the White House lawyer essentially saying we will not cooperate with the House of Representatives. We see it as because it violates our due process rights, or I guess the president's due process rights and the separation of powers. So the White House lawyer really threw down the gauntlet. What options does that give the House of Representatives?
Well, basically, they've said we don't have to hold this full House resolution that you're demanding that we do in order for you to cooperate. And frankly, it was interesting. They held a phone call with reporters as they were releasing the letter, and a senior White House official, you know, he refused to say if the House did have this resolution, that the White House would then begin cooperating with the impeachment inquiry. Mm. He said he wouldn't comment on hypotheticals, which I think raised a lot of eyebrows from reporters. But, you know, it kind of leaves the House with this choice where they can either go to court to try to demand this information, and that could slow down the whole process. It's a court case that's aimed straight for the Supreme Court about exactly how an impeachment inquiry can be played out. And that could take a year, 2 years, well after the president's term has expired.
Why does that take so long?
It just takes so long to get through the district court, to get through the appeals court, to go through the different procedural appeals at the appeals court, and then to get it to the Supreme Court and for the justices to decide on whether they'll take up the case and then hear the case and then rule on the case. It just adds weeks, which turn into months, which can turn into years. So basically what House Democrats are saying now is like, okay, if you aren't going to cooperate, we'll just draft that into an article of impeachment. We'll say you're obstructing and proper congressional inquiry into the potential impeachment of the president, and that in and of itself is an impeachable offense.
It just gets more and more complicated as yes, the days go on. But going back to our separation of powers and what small guidelines we have in the U.S. In the Constitution, does the House of Representatives have the right to investigate the executive, no matter who the executive is? I mean, I assume it has to be based on some kind of real concerns or accusations. But does the House have that right?
Under the current setup of the Constitution and precedent, yes, they do. They have oversight over the executive branch. The Oversight Committee in particular has oversight over that. And the House Judiciary Committee traditionally is the one that's tasked with handling impeachment inquiries. So they have oversight in that sense, that issue was raised late last week in the opinion over the Mazar subpoena for the president's financial documents from his private accounting firm that was issued by the House Oversight Committee. And the two of the three judges on the panel said, you know, Congress does have the right to obtain this kind of information in order to conduct its oversight duties. The other judge on the panel said the only way that they can do this is if it's part of an impeachment inquiry. And, well, it could potentially be folded into an impeachment inquiry.
How, though, then, there is a sergeant at arms. I don't mean to be overly dramatic here, but how does the House then enforce something like a subpoena?
So they have a few options on the table. There is the chance for criminal contempt, which is a resolution that we've seen already passed by the House for the Attorney General William Barr and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross over the census citizenship question. They voted to hold them in criminal contempt. That meant the matter was referred over to DOJ. And the DOJ lawyers said, we're not going to prosecute our boss, so that isn't going anywhere. The other way they have it is to do civil contempt, which basically just says we're going to go to court to enforce the subpoena. And then there's inherent contempt, which just hasn't been used in a while. But that is the process that you referred to earlier, where we have the sergeant in arms could take the person in question, just to use a name that's been in the news floating around the concept of inherent contempt, Corey Lewandowski. He could be taken to the House floor. They could hold a vote and say you are in contempt of Congress, and then put him in a holding cell or something along those lines in Capitol Hill. And that is a concept that has been backed by the Supreme Court within the past century. So that's a tool that they could use, but it is rare. And it would really have to be very extreme and extenuating circumstances for it to be utilized.
What does that holding cell look like? Do we know?
It used to be a jail in the Capitol. It no longer exists. I believe it was in the basement of the Library of Congress. Reporters have been walking around the building trying to figure out where one might be. But there was a piece in the New York Times by constitutional law professor Jason Chaffetz, who recently said, they can make a makeshift holding cell in the basement of one of these House office buildings and put someone in there.
Let me read a couple of comments. One from ATP. Once we knew there were tapes of Nixon, the person who said there were tapes was no longer relevant. Once we knew there was a call and had the transcript, the identity of the whistleblower was not relevant. Schiff is right to stop the White House from focusing on and attacking the whistleblower. And the little that I read about Schiff, at this point, he does not want the whistleblower to testify, and it seems that he wants to protect this person's identity. Anything you want can add to that, Jacqueline?
Yeah, that's definitely been a focus for the committees. There's been a lot of talk about how exactly the committees could hear testimony from this whistleblower, though each day it seems like there are other officials coming forward who are not this whistleblower, who are willing to speak on the record and publicly about this to the House without, having any concerns about their identity or their safety or potential reprisal from other higher officials. There have been talks about, do they have a secret testimony with the whistleblower from outside the Capitol? Do they, obscure his voice and his silhouette? Do they have it be over the phone? How do they do this in order to protect his identity? And I do think that they will ultimately want to hear from him in person, just because this was what triggered this entire situation that we're dealing with right now. But, like that commenter just mentioned, we're seeing a lot of evidence as corroborating what was in the whistleblower complaint. And frankly, the transcript of the call itself really brings that into question as well.
And that was the edited transcript coming from the White House. Let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation with Jacqueline Thompson. Again, she's a reporter for the National Law Journal covering D.C. courts and the legal side of politics, joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and if you're just joining us, Jacqueline Thompson is our guest. She's a reporter with the National Law Journal. We've been talking about the latest in the impeachment inquiry, some of the legal ins and outs of impeachment, what actually constitutes a constitutional crisis, and frankly, what comes next as we have this showdown between the House of Representatives and the White House over things like documents and testimony and subpoenas. Here's a comment from Rick. I'm not a Trump supporter, but I think this impeachment inquiry is doomed to fail. They did not take a full House vote and are not committed to getting him out of office. It's all for show. That's something, Jacqueline, you were referencing earlier. Here's a comment actually from Dave. He said, I heard your guest say that impeachment should be managed by the House Judiciary Committee. Why is the Intelligence Committee leading it this time? Can you answer, Dave?
That's a great question. The preceding investigation as part of an impeachment inquiry does not have to be led by House Judiciary. I should clarify that. Rather, the process of drafting the actual articles of impeachment and determining whether or not the alleged offenses by the president reach the level of impeachment would be done by House Judiciary. So what we're seeing right now is a really concerted joint effort led by the House Intelligence Committee, boosted by the House Oversight and House Foreign Affairs Committees, to come together and investigate the allegations surrounding Ukraine and anything else stemming from that. From there, they'll reach their findings and they'll refer them over to the House Judiciary Committee, which will put on their lawyer hats and start digging through the evidence, start going through and figuring out what exactly constitutes an impeachable offense from what the other committees have uncovered as a result of their investigations and interviews. From there, they can draft the articles of impeachment that will be voted on in committee. And once they're voted on in committee, if any of them make it out of that stage, then it could be brought to the full House for a vote.
And is it before foreign affairs, because we're dealing with a foreign government, essentially?
Yes. Those lawmakers definitely are very involved in all of this.
A question from Kyle. If a president can be indicted going forward, couldn't any president just get tied up in litigation from day one? Do you think that's a risk?
Yeah, sure. That's definitely a risk. But, you know, for a president to be indicted, the Department of Justice really has to reach a high bar in order for them to bring in bring a case against a sitting president of the United States. You know, the president has oversight over these federal prosecutors. The attorney general reports to him. Everyone below the attorney general reports to the attorney general. So that's honestly the reason why we have this OLC opinion in the first place. They said the president can't be indicted by the people he has oversight over. It raises questions over whether or not he could fire them and what kind of influence he could exert over the probe, yada, yada, yada. So we're seeing that concept raised in that question. But, you know, the president is tied up in litigation all the time, and it's not over whether he has done any criminal wrongdoing, which is the difference between getting tied up in litigation and being indicted by the Department of Justice.
And just to pick up on that, if we're talking about impeachment defined by the Constitution as high crimes and misdemeanors, this is often described as a political process, not a judicial process or proceeding. What is the difference, and why is that significant?
So it is an inherently political process, but it borrows a lot from legal proceedings. It's inherently political because it's done by politicians and it's done in a political body. And frankly, the courts wouldn't want to be involved in something like this at all. Judges are often wary in getting involved in interbranch disputes, like the way an impeachment inquiry would be, but they are more motivated to play that kind of third party when there is an impeachment inquiry involved. But regardless, you know, it is an inherently political process just because of the people that are involved within the proceedings themselves. But they do borrow heavily from judicial proceedings. We're seeing depositions, we're seeing subpoenas, we're seeing testimony and evidence. And then, you know, if articles of impeachment are passed and the president is impeached, we'll see a trial. And then we'll see, you know, cross-examinations and motions to dismiss. And those are all elements of the courts that we're seeing play out in a political body.
I think when we hear political process, we think of, at least in these days, a partisan process. Are we seeing that as well?
It's definitely having some partisan elements in terms of just who is supporting each side. The only non-Democrat, I believe, that's backing an impeachment inquiry at this point is Justin Amash, who left the Republican Party earlier this year. So that definitely brings things along party lines and adds a partisan element to it. And it's also, you know, different than in Watergate, for example, where basically almost the entire House voted to authorize the impeachment inquiry because they said we need to have this investigation and we need to figure out what's going on. And lawyers from both parties worked together to gather evidence and then to question witnesses. One of the most damning questions that revealed the White House secret recording system was asked by a Republican attorney.
That's right. I remember.
So, yeah, it really shows just how different things are right now.
Here's a follow-up question from Cletus saying, what are the origins of the Office of Legal Counsel memo that says a sitting president cannot be indicted? He asks, is it in the Constitution? It is not. But where did that come from, Jacqueline?
So that memo stemmed from a number of things. You know, there was a memo that wasn't an OLC opinion, but was written by Bork, who later went on to become a Supreme Court nominee, that said, you know, he went back when he was at the Department of Justice, that said a president can't be indicted because of these conflicts with DOJ and oversight over federal prosecutors and all those other tricky legal questions that come up. So basically, as Watergate was ongoing and there were questions about whether or not a president could be prosecuted at this level, that memo was drafted kind of in response to that to set the ground rules and say, no, a president cannot be criminally indicted while in office. He can be once he's out of office, but while in office, it raises too many constitutional questions that could really put the whole system in danger, so we aren't going to allow that to be happening.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Jacqueline Thompson, reporter for the National Law Journal, and we're kind of catching up on the last couple of weeks of impeachment inquiry news. And you can join us again. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me pick up on something you referenced earlier, which two courts, one from the Southern District of New York, one a federal appeals court, both ruling on President Trump's tax returns. What do we need to know?
So for both of those rulings, we've seen the judge basically say, you know, these returns can be handed over. In the New York case, it's actually around an investigation from the Manhattan DA, Cy Vance. They had issued a subpoena for these financial documents, and the president stepped in and said, the president's personal lawyers, I should clarify, stepped in and said, no, you cannot obtain these financial documents because the president cannot be indicted. He's in office. It would be an undue burden for him to carry out the duties of his office. The judge said, you can't sue at this point to block these documents from being handed over. This OLC memo that you cite does not grant the president blanket immunity, and it frankly raises concerns for me that you would argue that in the first place. So that right now at this point, there has been a stay issued on that order. The case has gone up to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. They're actually moving pretty quickly on that, and they'll have oral arguments by the end of the month, I believe, on that. And then, you know, once the Second Circuit issues their ruling, it's frankly very possible that whatever side will appeal that and will end up back at the Supreme Court. Go ahead.
No, just that feels like that will be its final resting place.
Yeah, it seems like every case is aimed directly at the Supreme Court.
I guess for political reasons, or just because that's the way our system works in terms of these, you know, this balance of powers.
Well, the president's lawyers haven't, you know, shied away from the fact that they do want all these cases going to the Supreme Court, and neither has the president. He said something kind of interesting the other day about how once he gets more of his nominees through the Senate for the courts, more decisions will be coming in his favor, which raises a lot of questions about exactly how he thinks these judges that he's nominating are going to be ruling on cases involving the president. But, you know, the president's lawyers have referenced the Supreme Court justices personally within the briefs that they've been filing in these cases. But it also raises really unique and novel legal questions about, you know, just how much access oversight bodies can gain to the private documents of a sitting president.
Well, it'll be interesting. I feel like all eyes will then be on Chief Justice John Roberts. It's his court, and it's his legacy on top of that.
Exactly.
Let me read an email from Margaret, who says, is Trump's act of withdrawing troops from Syria and allowing Turkey to invade grounds for impeachment? This is there is bipartisan criticism of his decision. Since we're talking about what constitutes high crimes and misdemeanors, how do you see that, Jacqueline?
You know, a lawmaker could decide that does constitute an impeachable offense. We've seen lawmakers in the past draft their own articles of impeachment for this president. Congressman Al Green comes to mind specifically for me right now. We saw articles of impeachment drafted after Charlottesville, where they said, you know, the president's rhetoric surrounding this, saying there are good people on both sides, was really reprehensible and therefore constituted an impeachable offense. And it, funny enough, Richard Nixon, he actually faced an article of impeachment surrounding the bombings in Cambodia well before Watergate really played out, that said, you know, having these bombings and not disclosing them to everyone constituted an impeachable offense. And that didn't go anywhere, but it definitely, you know, kind of raised pressure. But I think Democrats would really dissuade any lawmakers from drafting an article of impeachment surrounding the situation in Syria right now, just because they're afraid it would end up being a distraction from the main Ukraine probe.
Let me ask you about the testimony. It was behind closed doors, so we only know what she released and also what has kind of leaked out from her testimony. And this, of course, is the fired ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, and her allegations that she was basically fired because of an investigation to try to find some dirt on Joe Biden and his son. She did testify in defiance of the White House. Now, they haven't done anything about it, but does that put her in any legal jeopardy?
I don't think the White House will act on it, but they could potentially, you know, say this breached the terms of your employment. They could say, you know, we've seen this White House hasn't really been, you know, unbarred in its litigation strategy, at least this president, you could say. So, you know, maybe we see a personal lawsuit targeting her saying this caused damages to the president and this way or this way. But, you know, at this point, I really don't see that happening just because of how much is going on at this point. And, you know, it really comes down to whether or not any privileged information was shared during the interview with House investigators, because that does seem to be the White House's main argument. And I believe a lot of parties are being really cautious about what exactly is being shared during these interviews and during these depositions, because they don't want to put themselves in any danger of being accused of, you know, breaching that principle.
But I think we can all agree that it is, or maybe most of us can agree, that it is wrong, if not illegal, to ask a foreign country to find dirt on a political rival.
I believe that has been the consensus. The FEC chair, at least, has been very vocal about that being the situation.
And the acting Ukraine Ambassador Taylor is quoted in some of the texts that went public. Quote here, "I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign." Are we sort of getting more drips and drips closer to impeachment as you see it?
I do believe so, just if not from the lawmakers' reaction to what we're seeing. You know, a lot of reporters were staked out last night outside the Fiona Hill deposition, the former official on Russia for the Trump administration. And lawmakers that were coming out, they were not saying a lot. And normally they'll say, you know, what was damning, or we don't believe this amounted to anything, or whatever they feel like sharing with reporters. But they were pretty tight-lipped, and that's an indication that pretty compelling evidence or information was shared with them on this very private basis. And of course, some of it has leaked. But that, I think that is one sign that, you know, a lot of the evidence is building toward creating this case of impeachment for the president.
I had quoted the Washington Post in my introduction, alleging that Rudolph Giuliani was circumventing U.S. officials and career diplomats to personally benefit Donald Trump, saying that that's what Fiona Hill, Trump's ex-Russia advisor, had told the House yesterday.
Yeah, you know, Rudy Giuliani is right in the middle of this. We saw two of his business associates indicted. It is reported that he is now under investigation by federal prosecutors for violating foreign lobbying rules. He says he can't have violated foreign lobby rules because he was lobbying for the president, which is quite an interesting argument that we would have to see play out if anything ever does come of those reported investigations. But it really does seem that Giuliani, and this is evidenced by the transcript or memo of the phone call between Trump and Zelensky, really has been right in the middle of this, really has been playing this role that a lot of, you know, private people just aren't seeing play in this part of the government.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times, walking us through this really complicated series of news stories. Jacqueline Thompson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. A reporter for the National Law Journal covering D.C. courts and the legal side of politics. And she joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. Thanks to Tracy Matisak for filling in for me last week. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thank you for joining us.